Good afternoon, everybody. Would you please open your Bibles with me to the book of Hebrews? We're going to continue our study through that text tonight. We'll be picking up in Hebrews chapter 4, beginning in verse 14. Hebrews 4, 14. We'll do a very brief review as we get started. When we first started Hebrews, we had one way of outlining the book. We're going to kind of present a different outline tonight that I hope will be helpful to you as we continue to study and think about the message of this book together. The book, in one way, there are different ways to outline the book, but one way of looking at it is that the book divides into five parts with different focuses in each part. Chapters 1 and 2, chapter 3, and most of chapter 4, the rest of chapter 4 through chapter 7, chapter 8 through the first part of 10, and then 11 through 13 are kind of a one way of dividing up the book. And in the first four sections of Hebrews, there's a teaching section, and then there's an exhortation section. I put the teaching sections in blue, the exhortation sections in red. And kind of so the big picture of the book is there's exhortation in the first part, application in the second part. There's several New Testament letters that do that. But even within each section, there's kind of an exhortation as you go through. And in the first part of the book, the main message is that Jesus is greater than something or other from the Old Testament. And so chapters 1 and 2, we talked about that Jesus is greater than the angels, greater than the law, the Torah. It's because the angels were the messengers of the Torah, the Old Covenant. In the last section we studied, Jesus is greater than Moses, and he's greater than Canaan, the promised rest that they had. So superior to Joshua and the things that he did for God's people. We begin a section tonight in chapter 4, verse 14, that will carry us all the way through chapter 7 and is one of the main themes in Hebrews. And that is that Jesus is superior to the priests and the priesthood. He is our great high priest. And this is kind of at the middle of the book. And then Jesus will also be superior to the Old Covenant and to the sacrifices in Hebrews. And then each of these kind of comes with its corresponding exhortation. Jesus is superior to the messengers of the Old Covenant, so we need to pay closer attention to what we've heard. We've received something greater with the New Covenant. Jesus offers us a greater rest. Don't harden your hearts like they did, so encourage one another day after day, and be diligent to enter that rest, is the exhortation that we just finished with in our last study. And the exhortation is kind of in the middle of this next part, and he goes on an aside to say, you need to grow up. You need to press on to maturity in the midst of this, understanding these things about Jesus. And the last one, there's an exhortation section that kind of flows into the last exhortation section of Hebrews that we need to draw near and to hold fast. And in the last part of Hebrews, when we get there, there's examples of faith, endurance, and discipline, Sinai and Zion, and pleasing sacrifices and kind of assorted exhortations at the end of the letter. So this is just another way to kind of mentally map the book. I really am a visual person. I like things. I saw something like this recently on Hebrews. I've modified it a little bit. But something like this helps me to kind of keep it organized in my head. So tonight, we're right there with the yellow box. We're going to be introducing this section on Jesus' superiority to the priests and the priesthood. So, if you will, read with me Hebrews chapter 4, beginning in verse 14. Kind of an unfortunate chapter break here. We're going to go all the way down through 5:10, as this is kind of a unit in the text. Hebrews 4, 14. Since then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God. Let us hold fast our confession, for we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. For every high priest chosen from among men is appointed to act on behalf of men in relation to God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins. He can deal gently with the ignorant and wayward, since he himself is beset with weakness. Because of this, he is obligated to offer sacrifice for his own sins, just as he does for those of the people. And no one takes this honor for himself, but only when called by God, just as Aaron was. So also Christ did not exalt himself to be made a high priest, but was appointed by him who said to him, "You are my son, today I have begotten you." As he says also in another place, "You are a priest forever, after the order of Melchizedek." In the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who is able to save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverence. Although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered. And being made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him, being designated by God a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. So the Hebrew writer introduces this great theme of Jesus as the high priest, and what's kind of interesting is in the next section he's going to say, about this we have much to say, and it's hard to explain since you become dull of hearing, and he kind of transitions and interrupts his thought, and is like, I want to say more about this, but I need to say something first. And he's going to have the exhortation section there, and then come back to Melchizedek in all of chapter 7. But backing up to the beginning of this section, he actually in some ways begins this section with an exhortation, with one of these, therefore, since we, let us do that. And it's just, you see that over and over. And so what's that construction here at the beginning? This section is on the what makes Jesus qualified to be our high priest. So he says, since we have a great high priest who first has done what? Verse 14. He's passed through the heavens. So there's some debate over what that means. I think the idea here, though, is that he passed from heaven to earth. Is the idea that he has become one of us. That's what he's going to go on to emphasize in this section. Is he has become one of us. He's already made this point in chapter 2, but here he's going to tie it in with the idea of the high priesthood. He's passed through the heavens. And since we have this high priest who has been tempted in every respect as we are, yet without sin. And I want to dwell on this for just a minute because this is a powerful thought when we think about Jesus. Jesus lived 2,000 some years ago in a place that was very different than where we live now, although it has a lot of the same struggles. It's easy for us to kind of have this cartoon Jesus in our head when we see pictures of him, or, you know, this is what Jesus might have looked like, and kind of like he's like this storybook character that, you know, lived a long time ago. But Jesus became a human being who is every bit as real and every dealt with the same things that we dealt with. I don't fully understand the humanity and the deity of Jesus. That's a difficult concept for us to completely wrap our minds around. But I want us to read carefully what this verse says. Verse 15, "For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin." That's an amazing thing to kind of meditate on and to dwell on, that Jesus, being God, became human, took on flesh, and was tempted in the same types of ways that we are. And it says he was tempted in every respect. Now, that doesn't mean that he faced literally every single situation. He didn't grow to be old. He didn't face necessarily every sickness. But I think the idea here is that in every type of way that we're tempted, he was tempted. And think about this for just a minute. If you kind of were to make a list, how was Jesus tempted while he was on this earth? Here's just a short start to that list. And the idea behind this is that Jesus understands. He is able to sympathize with our weaknesses. Jesus got tired. He was thirsty, and he was hungry. You read about that in various passages. The woman at the well, he was tired, so he sat down. He was hungry. I thirst, is what he said on the cross. Jesus was tempted to do some things that he shouldn't do. That was one of the things that Satan presented to him. Turn these stones into the bread. Throw yourself off from the temple. There were things that Jesus was not supposed to do that he was tempted to do those things. Jesus was also tempted to not do something that he should do. When Jesus was in the Garden of Gethsemane, what did he pray? "It is possible. Let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not what I will, but what you will. Not my will, but yours be done. So he was tempted to not do something that he should have done. He faced the same kind of trials day after day after day, and even from his own disciples. You ever struggled with being patient with somebody? There's a couple of times where Jesus is like, foolish generation, how long am I going to have to put up with you, basically? He got frustrated at times, but Jesus never gave up on his disciples, on his friends. Even though they failed him and misunderstood him and all sorts of problems, he knows what it's like to face those same trials day after day. Jesus was misunderstood. He was misrepresented. He was slandered. He was persecuted. You deal with these kind of things. Jesus understands what you're going through. He was tempted in every way as we are, yet without sin. He was offered great reward to compromise, saying, you know, if you bow down and worship me, I'll give you all the kingdoms of the world. What would you add to this list up here? We could do a whole study on just that right there, and maybe we should sometime. Whatever it is that you're going through, Jesus is qualified to be our high priest because he can sympathize with our weaknesses and then go to God on our behalf, not as some unfeeling, going to misrepresent us and the things that we go through, but Jesus went through the same types of temptations that we went through and then is able to plead our case to the Father as we turn to him for his blood, and he can cover us. He is the perfectly qualified mediator between God and man, because being fully God, he was still fully man and fully tempted, but yet without sin. Lots more we could say about that, but I hope that's encouraging for you to go think about that some more after our lesson tonight. And so the two let us, because we have such a high priest who has been tempted just as we are. First of all, he already said in verse 14, let us hold fast our confession. He'll expand on that more later in the book. And second, in verse 16, let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace. And I don't know if you've ever really thought about drawing near to the very throne of God. When people got near to the presence of God or the throne of God in the Bible, what did they do? Was it confident? They fall on their face and they're just like, woe is me. I'm a sinful person. And yet he says, because we have this kind of high priest, this mediator between us and God, let us draw near with confidence to the throne of grace. Sometimes we sing that song, And Can It Be, which combines some of these ideas, doesn't it? You left your Father's throne above, so free and infinite your grace, emptied yourself of all but love, and bled for Adam's helpless race. He becomes man, he's tempted, he dies. And then the third verse, boldly I come before your throne to claim your mercy, immense and free. No greater love will ever be known. For, oh my God, it found out me. That's comes straight from this verse, this idea that instead of approaching the throne of wrath, instead of approaching the throne of judgment, which it is a throne of wrath and it is a throne of judgment, as you see throughout the scriptures and the Psalms and different places. But he says, because we have a high priest, we can draw near the throne. How does he describe it? The throne of grace. And isn't that an awesome image? That God, even in his power and even in his justice, his throne is a throne of grace to those who draw near by the blood of Jesus. What a high priest. In chapter 5, he transitions a thought and kind of makes some comparisons and some contrasts with the earthly high priest. He says that every high priest from among men is chosen to act on behalf of men in relation to God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins. And I think that kind of describes the two general types of offerings. Some were to say thank you, and some were to say I'm sorry, basically. And so the gifts are like the idea of saying thank you to God. The sacrifices for sins is saying, I'm sorry, please forgive me for that. So the earthly high priest is this mediator between man and God. He's coming to God on behalf of man. And of course, Jesus does the same kind of thing for us. And he's able to sympathize with our weaknesses. And it says the same thing about the earthly high priest in verse 2. He can deal gently with the ignorant and wayward, since he himself is beset with weakness. So that's a comparison that he's just pointed out. Jesus is tempted like we are. The high priest can understand the things that people go through because he's human too. But the contrast is in verse 3. Because of this, he, the earthly high priest, is obligated to offer sacrifice for his own sins just as he does for those of the people. And of course, this is not true of Jesus, because Jesus was tempted in every way as we are, yet without sin. Jesus' offering is of himself. He is the sacrifice, and he is the high priest. He doesn't have to make a sacrifice for himself. He does that for us, because that's what we need. So there's some comparison, some contrast there. And the next point that he makes is that Jesus did not appoint himself to the high priesthood, but God appointed him just as Aaron did. And by the way, as you're kind of making this list of Jesus is greater than, Jesus is greater than Aaron. This is maybe the only time that Aaron himself is mentioned in the text. And that's just kind of an interesting thing. He's greater than Aaron and the Levitical priesthood, which will be discussed at length in chapter 7. So he quotes here from a couple of different Old Testament psalms. Again, this book of Psalms is the most quoted book of the Old Testament in the New Testament. And he quotes from two of the royal psalms here, Psalm 2 in verse 7 and Psalm 110 in verse 4. Again, Psalm 2, he who sits in the heavens laughs. You know, why are the nations in an uproar? And this picture of God just on his throne, not worried about what's going on. And it quotes the section that says, you are my son, today I have begotten you. And he connects that idea of Jesus being begotten. It's not that he was created, but that he took on this role as God's son. And that that's connected with his priesthood. That today, you are my son, today I have begotten you. He appoints Jesus to this role as the son of God, the great high priest, as he does this. And then in Psalm 110, as he says in another place, you are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Again, Psalm 110 is the most quoted psalm of the Psalms, and it's quoted a whole bunch here in the book of Hebrews. We've already talked a bit about Psalm 110 already. So you are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. And this is important as we think about Jesus' role, is that Jesus is not running a Jesus for High Priest campaign. You know, he's not about himself. He's not calling attention or glory to himself. But he has this exalted role because he submitted to the will of the Father. And the Father chose to appoint him as our great High Priest. And there's lessons of humility in that. There's lessons of submission in that. And we're going to see that as that's connected to this next section here, that God is the one who chose him to be High Priest. In verses 7 through 10, it goes back to this idea of even though he's exalted, he still suffers as a son of God. In the days of his flesh, he offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save his soul from death. When did Jesus do that during his life? I don't know if it necessarily records the loud cries and stuff. I'm assuming some of that would be the Garden of Gethsemane. But there may have been other times during Jesus' ministry when he spends all night in prayer to God and is asking for wisdom and looking to appoint the 12, and other times in his life. We don't know even a fraction, really, of the things that Jesus did. But we have recorded for us that Jesus suffered. And Jesus learned to trust. We talked about that concept back in chapter 2, if you remember, verse 13. And again, I will put my trust in him. And again, behold, I and the children God has given me. Jesus didn't become a human to show us how to be God in the flesh. He became human to show us how to be humans, created in the image of God and serving as God wants us to serve. Jesus learned to rely on the Father, to do only what he saw the Father do. As you read that, especially in the book of John, I don't do anything on my own authority, only what I see the Father do. Jesus suffered. He really suffered and went through the same kind of things that we went through. And here it says that that is what made him learn obedience. Verse 8, although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered. Again, this role of Jesus as a son has been used already in Hebrews to talk about he's a son in God's house. Moses is just a servant in God's house. And even though he has the exalted position, he suffered for us. And he's made perfect in that suffering, verse 9, which is, again, a lot of this connects back to chapter 2. In verse 10, he should make the founder of their salvation perfect through suffering, chapter 2, verse 10. And so he says, being made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him, being designated by God a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. And then he interrupts his flow of thought. But I want you to notice a parallel here. Jesus had to do what in respect to God in verses 7 and 8? He suffered and he learned obedience. And what did God do for Jesus? What was God able to do for Jesus in those verses? Verse 7 particularly. He was able to save him, right? So that's kind of the pattern that Jesus sets for us, is he is obedient to God though he is suffering, and God answers his prayer for salvation. God's able to save him from death. And notice in verse 9, and being made perfect, what does Jesus now become? He is the source of eternal salvation to all who do what? All who obey him. You see that the way those two ideas are just turned around. Jesus obeyed God, and God saved him. Now, Jesus, we obey him, and he saves those who are obedient to him. Jesus is not asking us to do anything that he has not already done himself. Doesn't that make him the perfect high priest? He has gone before us, has shown us the perfect way, and now he is our mediator. And we can come boldly before the throne of grace to find mercy and to find help in time of need.